Just having some dessert, I said lightly. Looks delicious. He made a couple of warthoggish snorts, as if shocked that I had the gall to ignore his attempt to rile me up. I was talking to you, he finally said, his voice low and menacing. And I was politely ignoring you. I mustered up my bravery and slid him a warning glance. I'm a guest in this house, and I plan on acting like one. Maybe you should too. That was the end of the discussion, because his next step was physical. He reached out and grabbed my arm, then jerked me forward, spewing curses at me as he moved. I jerked back to try to free my arm, dropping the plate in my hand. It hit the floor and shattered, crumbs and porcelain flying across the floor. But before I could react, he was gone. Because before I could react, Ethan had the man by the collar of his shirt and was pushing him back toward the wall. Keep your hands off her, he gritted out. With a quick twist of his hands, the shifter threw Ethan's arms away, then gave him a powerful shove for good measure. Who the fuck do you think you are? Ethan stumbled back a couple of feet, but leaned forward quickly enough again, apparently intent on making a second run at the guy. You come anywhere near her again, and you'll answer to me. Pack be damned. Shock giving way to political awareness, I reached out and grabbed his arm, then hauled him around so he and the shifter weren't facing each other down. Ethan, I whispered fiercely, calm down. Gabriel rushed toward us, Fallon and Adam behind him. What the fuck is going on here? The ballroom went completely silent, all eyes on the vampires creating chaos in the midst of their party. The shifter rolled his shoulders as if tossing off the insult, then pointed at Ethan. I was having a conversation with this vampire, and then this asshole pushed me, and now I'm going to push him back. Thank God I was a vampire, as that added dose of strength was the only thing that allowed me to hold Ethan back. He made another drive, enough to carry me forward a couple of feet before I could stop him again. Adam and Fallon jumped between the two of them, ready to intervene if he tried again. Ethan, I mentally told him, stop it. Enough. He grabbed her, Ethan said through clenched teeth, then shook off my arms. I'm fine. He pushed his hands through his hair. I'm fine. And you need to get your shifters under control. Gabriel stared at Ethan, his expression fierce, his hands clenched into fists. Magic rose again, a suffocating cloud of it, as he decided our fate. I cursed mentally, assuming this was the end of our shifter detente. But just then, Tanya stepped behind him. One hand on her stomach, she reached out with the other to touch Gabriel's back. As if answering her caress, Gabriel glanced between me and Ethan, and after a moment, I watched understanding soften the fury in his face. He'd figured out that Ethan had nearly taken a shot at one of his pack members, because that pack member had nearly taken a shot at me. After a moment of silence, Gabriel took a step toward Ethan, then leaned in as though offering advice to a colleague. If you want this friendship to work, then you will keep yourself in line. I get your reasons, he said, pausing for emphasis. But this kind of shit will not fly. Not with my pack. Not with my people. Ethan nodded, his gaze on the ground. Gabriel's voice softened. Are you going to be ready to work the convocation tomorrow? Of course. After a moment, he nodded. Then I'm taking your word on that, and that's good enough for me. He stood straight again. We're done here, he announced to the room. It's over, it's over. And everything's fine, so let's get back to dinner, shall we? Then he took Tanya's hand and approached my aggressor, clasping a big hand on his shoulder. Let's go have a drink and talk about manners. As he moved into the crowd, the din of noise and conversation began to envelop us again. We should go, Ethan said. I nodded and let him lead me out. He was silent on the way to the car. That silence and the ensuing tension thickened the air in the car until we were well away from the Breckenridge property and on our way back to Hyde Park. I'd seen his protectiveness twice now. His gestures had been powerful, but they had also put uneasiness between us. As if the gestures were too powerful for a relationship as new and green as ours. My reaction was uncalled for, he finally said. You thought he was going to hurt me? Ethan shook his head. I've been critiquing Morgan. I've complained that he overreacts, that he allows his emotions to get in the way of the needs of his house. My stomach twisted, and I had the sickening feeling that I knew where this conversation was going. Ethan, I said, but he shook his head. If Morgan had pulled that stunt, I'd have taken him out. I'd have hauled him out of the room and reminded him of his obligations, of his duties to his house and the rest of them. I'm frankly surprised Gabriel didn't take action of his own. Gabriel hadn't, I thought, because with a touch, Tanya had reminded Gabriel of the reason Ethan had acted, for me. You stepped in to protect me. It's understandable. It's unacceptable, he countered. That word stung like a punch, and I turned my face to the passenger side window so he couldn't see the tears that had begun to fill my eyes. However grand his gesture at the Breck house, Ethan was preparing his excuse. I could have mooted all of Gabriel's overtures, destroyed all the good rapport he's been building between shifters and vampires, because of my reaction. Just like that, he added, snapping his fingers. Then he went quiet for a moment. It's been a long time for me since I've cared for someone, since I've allowed instinct to take over. His voice softened, as if he'd forgotten I was in the car. I should have seen it coming. I should have considered the possibility that I'd react in such a way. Was I supposed to appreciate the admission that he cared for me when he was drowning in regret about it? What if Gabriel did offer an alliance, friendship, because of what you'd done for Berna? If we continued our relationship and our emotions became intertwined, entangled, and it came to the same end as yours and Morgan's, what then? All the bitterness, the bad feelings. What was I supposed to say? Was I supposed to argue with him? Remind him of the physical bliss? Reassure him that he wasn't Morgan and that our relationship was different? If we form an allegiance with the Pack, we'll have made history. We'll have made an allegiance that's unique in history. And now my reaction has put that allegiance at risk. If that's how I'm going to react, then I'm not ready for this. Maybe not capable of it. Not when it puts the safety and security of the house at risk. He was quiet for a moment. There are 300 Cadogan vampires, Merritt. And I'm one of those 300, I silently thought, and forced myself to ask the next question. So what are you saying? I'm saying I can't do this. Not now. Things are too fragile. I waited to speak until I was sure my voice wouldn't waver. I don't want to just pretend it didn't happen. I don't have the luxury of remembering. A girl isn't reason enough to throw away my house. I swallowed the lump in my throat and, with tears drying on my cheeks, made my decision. I'd spurned Ethan's advances when he'd offered just sex, but I'd given in when he'd said he needed me. In fact, he'd decided I was disposable. I felt stupid, naive, but I wouldn't let him see it. So I locked down my heart and found I could speak in that same cold voice he'd used. You've changed your mind before. If you end it now and change your mind again, I won't come back. I'll stand sentinel, but only as your employee, not as your lover. It took a moment for him to answer and break my heart. Then that's the risk I take. We rode home in silence, broken only by Ethan's reminder that we were meeting with Luke before dawn to discuss the convocation. I managed not to reach across the center console and throttle him, but as soon as we were parked in the garage, I jumped out of the car and headed up the basement stairs and out the front door again. There were hours yet until dawn, and I couldn't spend them in the house. I was too embarrassed to stay there. Too humiliated at having been so unceremoniously dumped for the possibility of Ethan's burgeoning friendship with Gabriel. He'd given me up because dating me risked his bond with the pack. A bond, ironically enough, that I'd helped create. I got into my car and headed north across the river, hoping distance would ease the hurt. At the very least, I wouldn't have to cry within earshot of Katagund vampires. I should have known better. I should have known he wasn't capable of adapting, that he would always pick strategy over love, that no matter the words he'd used, he was still the same cold bloodsucker. I considered calling Noah and consenting to join the Red Guard right then and there, consenting to partner with Jonah to oversee the Masters, to judge them, to take action when they fall short of their potential. But that was a betrayal I still couldn't commit. Ethan had his reasons for deciding a relationship between us wouldn't work. Even if I didn't agree with them, I understood them. None of that, unfortunately, diminished the embarrassment, the feeling that I'd offered and been found lacking, the feeling that being put aside was wholly my own doing. And, most important, the feeling that in taking Ethan's side, I'd stood against one of two people in the world who loved me unconditionally. That regret sent me to Wicker Park, not even sure if she'd be there, but without a better idea. I parked outside her narrow brownstone and hopped up the stairs, then knocked on the door. She opened it a second later. Her ice-blue hair was getting longer and now reached her shoulders. She wore a simple skirt and short-sleeved shirt, her feet bare, her toes painted in a rainbow of colors, from indigo to red. Her smile faded almost immediately. "Mare? What is it?" Despite the speech I'd planned on the way over, a regret-filled, "I'm sorry," was all I managed to get out. "I'm so, so sorry." Mallory gave me an up-and-down appraisal before meeting my gaze again. "Oh, Merritt, tell me you didn't." Chapter 13, You're My Best Friend. Mallory knew me way too well. I gave her a pitiful smile. She stepped aside and held open the door. Walking into the foyer, I was immediately comforted by the sounds and smells of home. Lemon furniture polish, cinnamon and sugar, the slightly musty smell of an older home, the low murmur of the television. "Couch," she directed. "Sit." I did, taking a seat on the middle cushion. Mallory grabbed a handful of tissues from a box on the side table, then sat beside me, handed them over, and pushed the hair from my face. "Tell me." I did. I told her about the shifter bar, the pizza, the chocolate. I told her about the party, Gabriel's friendship, and the bully, about Ethan's reaction and the risk he was willing to take. By the end of it, I was in her arms, crying into her shoulder. Crying like a girl whose heart had been shattered into tiny, brittle pieces, even if it had been my fault for falling in the first place. "I gave him the benefit of the doubt," I said, mopping at my face with a tissue. "At first I thought, oh, he's just afraid. He just can't give more because he's not capable right now." I shook my head. "It's not because he isn't capable. It's because he wants something else." That sickening feeling rolled through my stomach again, that horrible twist that only rejection could trigger. Mallory sat back on the couch, hands in her lap, and sighed long and hard. "In this case, Merritt, and I don't want to make a martyr of him, because he's far beneath our consideration at the moment, it's probably a little of both. I've seen him with you. I've seen the way he looks at you. I know I'm hard on him." Her voice softened. "I know I was hard on you. But there's more than just desire in his eyes when he looks at you. It's not just the physical stuff. There's something else, some kind of affection, maybe. Some kind of appreciation that's not just about hormones and pink parts. The problem is, he's a 400-year-old vampire. He's not human, and he hasn't been in a long time. We don't even know if he thinks the same or wants the same things." "Don't blame the vampire," I told her. "That doesn't get him off the hook." "Oh, trust me," she said. You give me 10 minutes alone with Darth Sullivan, and he will feel my most excellent wrath. A tingle of magic lit the air and sent a prickle of foreboding down my spine. Powerful was my sorceress friend. All I'm saying is, it sounds as if he doesn't think he has a choice. That's not an excuse, but it's an explanation. I blew out a slow breath and knuckled tears from beneath my eyes. It's not as if I don't know these things. I know he's not human, not really, even though he has these incredibly vulnerable moments that make my heart clench. You should have seen him when he jumped the shifter, Mallory. He went ballistic, shoved the guy against a wall. Just like I would have done, but with sorcerer juju instead of vampire juju. I nodded. But you wouldn't have regretted it. He did. Gabriel understood why he'd done it. I know he did. But that wasn't good enough. I mean, it's as if I'm being punished because Ethan's black nugget of a heart actually started beating again. It's definitely not fair, hon. And I wish I had some magic thing to say that would fix the whole scenario, but I don't. It's just, I know he's not perfect. He can be cold and controlling. But I've seen that passion, the affection that he's locked away. I've seen what he's capable of. He's just, he's also, I don't know. He's Ethan. I looked over at her and sniffed. He's Ethan. For some bizarre reason, he seems to be your Ethan. And for better or worse, you seem to be his merit. That irritates me on a daily basis. I'm so stupid. Not stupid. Just a little too human for your own good. I didn't mention that we'd both criticized Morgan for exactly the same thing. Sometimes too human, sometimes not human enough. And either way, sometimes a stone-cold idiot. Now that, Mallory said, I can agree with. He's been in love, you know. Mallory looked over at me. In love, Ethan? I nodded and relayed the information Lindsay had once passed along. Her name was Lacey Sheridan. She was a guard for a couple of decades, I guess. Lindsay thinks he was in love with her, although they broke it off years ago when she started her own house. She's a master? 1 of 12. Is it perfectly fitting that if you were the next master in line, you'd be the 13th house? Given my luck, pretty damned appropriate. She rose off the couch, then walked toward the hallway. Come on, genius, let's get you something to eat. I wrapped my hands around my stomach, which was just beginning to stop swimming. I'm not hungry. She glanced back and offered me a flat stare. Well, not that hungry, I said, but followed her to the kitchen anyway. I had missed dessert, after all. Dear Lord, I said, stepping into the kitchen. What had once been a tiny cottage kitchen had become a, well, I wasn't sure what to call it. The potions classroom from Hogwarts, maybe? I walked to the kitchen island and trailed my fingers over stacks of books, a deck of tarot cards, boxes of salt, glass jars of feathers, grapevines, corked bottles of oils, matches, and dried rose petals. I plucked a card from the tarot deck, the Ace of Swords. Fitting, I thought, placing the card gingerly atop the rest of the deck. What is all this stuff? Homework, she grumbled. Oh my God, it is Hogwarts. She gave me a snarky look and began to clear off an area on the island. I'm playing catch up with little witches who've been doing this stuff for years. I pulled out a stool and sat down. I thought you were training alone. I am, but I'm not the first student my teacher's had before he was sent to the Siberia of sorcery. Schomburg? Schomburg, she confirmed. Before that, he taught lots and lots of kids. Kids who were much younger than me when they got their magic. Turns out, hitting my magical stride at 27 puts me pretty far behind the rest of the pack. I bet you make up for it with sass and charm. She narrowed her gaze. I make up for it by being twice as powerful as anyone else. For cereal? Completely for cereal. I surveyed the spread on the table. So why the homework? I distinctly remember a lecture by Catcher about how you guys don't have to use spells or potions or whatever. I drop my voice an octave and bob my shoulders in what I'm sure was an Oscar-worthy impression of Catcher Bell. But could funnel the power directly through your bodies. Was that supposed to be Catcher? Kinda, yeah. Huh. Sounded more like John Goodman. I'm not an actress. I just play one on TV. Get to the point. This will shock you, Mallory said, pulling out a stool beside me and plopping down. But it turns out Catcher's a little pretentious about the magic thing. I snorted. I feel bad you're only just figuring that out. As if there was a way to miss it. Consider anything that comes out of his mouth about magic, except for the major keys, he's got those right, to be a matter of opinion. He thinks the only legit way to do magic is to will things to happen. That's not true, she said, shoulders slumped as she surveyed the pile of materials. Sorcerers are like craftsmen of magic. Craftsmen how? Well, the four keys are a little like painting. You got folks who paint with oils, with acrylics, with watercolors. In the end, you still get art. You just use different tools to get there. You can use any of the four keys to make magic. She held up a cork-stoppered glass jar of white powder to the light and spun it around like a connoisseur might twirl a glass of wine before taking a sip. Its pearlescent sparkle made it seem extraordinarily white, densely white. Ground unicorn horn? I wondered. Glitter from that craft store on Division? Close enough, I said. I fingered the Katagun medal at my neck, working up the nerve to get out the thing we hadn't talked about yet, the speech I hadn't yet made. I've missed you. She swallowed, but didn't look at me. I've missed you too. I wasn't there for you, not like you were for me. Mallory blew out a slow breath. No, Merritt, you weren't. But I was unfair about the Morgan thing. I didn't mean to push you. I just didn't want you to get hurt. And that thing I said about my daddy issues, that one still stung. Completely uncalled for. I am so sorry. I nodded, but the silence returned again, as if we hadn't quite worked through the wall of awkwardness between us. Turns out, I was completely right about the Ethan thing. I rolled my eyes, and so humble about it, too. Fine, yes, you were right. He is, dangerous. And I fell right into his trap. She opened her mouth to speak, then snapped it shut again. She shook her head, as if unable to decide whether to voice the words in her head. When she did decide, the words flew out in a rush. Okay, I am so sorry, but I have to ask, how was it? I mean, seriously, grade A asshole or not, the man is gorgeous. A corner of my mouth quirked up into a smile. It was almost worth the emotional trauma. How almost? Multiple times almost. Huh, she said. That both figures, as pretty as he is, and irritates. You kinda hope a guy who pulls a stunt like he did this evening is seriously lacking in the nookie skills department. And your performance? Mallory. She made the sign of a cross over her chest. I have a point, I swear. I rolled my eyes, but grinned a little. I was impressive. So impressive that the next time he sees you in that leather, he's going to rue walking out? I grinned at her. Now I recall why I best friended you. You have a faulty memory. I best friended you. We looked at each other for a minute, schoolgirl silly grins on our faces. We were back. A few minutes and the replay of a few Sex and the City worthy details later, Mallory was off her stool and headed for the fridge. I have some cold pizza if you want some, she said, but I'll warn you, it's a little different. I picked up a foot-long black feather and twirled it in my hand. How different? Catcher Bell different. She opened the fridge, pulled out a wide, flat pizza box, and shut the door again with a bump. I leaned up and used both hands to push containers out of the way, leaving a bare spot big enough for the pizza box. This one was from another Wicker Park joint, the kind that made artisanal pizza with goat cheese and organic herbs. It wasn't my favorite, but it definitely had its place in my repertoire. Hand-pulled crust, homemade sauce, coins of fresh mozzarella. How different could it be? I asked. And then she placed the box on the island and flipped it open. I stared at it, tilted my head at it, trying to figure out what, exactly, he'd done to pizza. Is that celery? And carrots? And mashed potatoes? It was like being dumped all over again, but this time by something I never imagined would hurt me. I looked up at Mallory, despair in my eyes, then pointed down at the pizza again. Is that a pea on pizza? It's some kind of shepherd's pie thing. His mom was experimenting one day and made it, and it's the only good thing from his childhood or something. And he paid the restaurant a buttload of cash to make it. My shoulders slumped, and my voice went petulant. But it's pizza! If it makes you feel better, they protested pretty well, Mallory said. They tried to sell us a cream cheese and double bacon. The official pizza of the Merritt Carmichael ticket, I put in. But Catcher can beg as well as the rest of them, Mal smiled knowingly. Not that I know anything about that. I groaned, but grinned. If Mallory was back to discussing doing it with Catcher, our friendship was on the mend. Still, not anything I needed to know about. That's disgusting. He was my trainer. So was Ethan, she pointed out, and look how well that turned out. At least you've notched your bedpost with a master vampire, and you can finally move on. She got very still, then glanced at me. You are moving on, right? Something in my stomach flipped over and clenched. It took a minute before I could answer. Yeah, I told him it was his one chance, that if he left, the risk was on him. I shrugged. He opted for the risk. His loss, Mare. His loss. Easy to say that, but I'd feel better if he slipped into a profound depression or something. I bet he's doing that right now, probably flogging himself as we speak. There's no need to be dramatic, just like there's no need to waste this, let's not call it pizza, carrot concoction. And so I let her ply me with leftover shepherd's pie pizza, and when I'd finished, because she'd offered me the one thing she hadn't previously been willing to give me, understanding about Ethan. I gave her the thing I hadn't previously been willing to give her. Time. Can I tell you about the magic now? She sheepishly asked. Let her rip, tater chip, I told her, and gave her my full attention. She sat cross-legged on her kitchen stool, hands in the air, as she prepared to tell me the things I hadn't made time to hear before. She started with the basics. Okay, she began. So you know about the four major keys. I nodded. The divisions of magic. Weapons, beings, power, texts. Catcher had taught me that lesson. Right. Well, as I was saying before, those are like your paints, your tools for making things happen. I frowned, put an elbow on the island, and put my chin in my hand. And what kind of things can you make happen exactly? The whole range, she said, from Merlin to Marie Laveau. And you can use one or more of the keys to do it. Power, that's the first key. It is the elemental force, the pure expression of will. The only legitimate way to perform magic in Catcher's eyes, Mallory nodded. And the irony is, he is a master of the second key. Weapons, I offered, and she nodded again. Right, but lots of those things can be weapons. She spread her arms over her piles of materials. All this stuff. Potions, ruins, fetishes, and not the sex kind, she added, as if anticipating that I'd make a snarky comment. Fair enough, 'cause I would have. None of it is inherently magical, but when you put them together in the right combinations, you create a catalyst for a magical reaction. I frowned. What about my sword? Remember when Catcher pricked your palm? Tempered the blade with blood? I nodded. He'd done that in my grandfather's backyard on the evening of my 28th birthday. I'd had the ability to sense steel from that night on. Yep, I said, rubbing my palm sympathetically. Your blade had potential. When you tempered the blade, you brought forth that potential, making it real. Now, the last two major keys are obvious. Beings. Creatures that are inherently magical. Sorcerers can do it. Vampires kind of shed it. Shifters are all over it. And texts. Books, spells, written names, words that operate like the blood you shed on your blade. Catalysts for magic? Exactly. That's why spells and incantations work. The words together in the right order, with the right power behind them. So you've learned all this stuff, I said, sitting up again. Can you actually use it? Maybe. She uncrossed her legs and turned back to the island, looked over the spread of stuff, then plucked a thin glass canister of what looked like birch bark from the array. Can you grab something for me? There's a little black notebook on the coffee table in the living room. It has gold writing on the spine. Are you going to work some magical mojo? I'd get off your butt before I turn you into a toad, yes. I hopped off my stool. If you turned me into a toad, you'd have already worked your mojo. You're too smart for your own good, she called out, but I was already heading down the hallway. The house looked pretty much the same as it had the last time I'd visited, a couple of weeks ago. Although there was more evidence of a boy in residence, random receipts here and there. A pair of beat-up running shoes, a copy of Men's Health on the dining room table, a stack of audio equipment in one corner. So as I trolled back into the living room, I was prepared to see guy stuff. Balled-up sweat socks, maybe, or a half-empty can of Pabst, or a bottle of 312, or whatever catcher drank. I wasn't prepared for an empty room that had been filled with furniture only a little while ago. Holy shit, I swore, hands on my hips as I surveyed the room. Mal, I called out. Come here. I think you were robbed. But how could they have moved out an entire room full of furniture and knickknacks and without our knowing it? Look up! Seriously, come here! I'm not kidding! Merritt! She yelled back. Just flippin' look up! I did. My mouth dropped. Holy shit! The room had gone completely poltergeist. All of the furniture, from the couch to the end table to the entertainment console and television, was on the ceiling. Everything was in its place, but everything was upside down. It was like standing beneath the looking glass, a mere image of what had been here before. It was also as if gravity took a vacation. I saw the tiny black book Mallory wanted, but it was stuck to the top, bottom, of the coffee table that was now perched a few feet above my head. I guess I could jump for it, I murmured with a small smile, then instinctively glanced back toward the door. She stood in the doorway, arms over her chest, one ankle crossed over the other, a supremely smug smile on her face. You know, you look just like Catcher when you stand like that. Mallory, this girl who'd mooted gravity, stuck out her tongue at me. I guess you learned a few things. She shrugged, then pushed off the door. How did you do it? I asked, walking around, head tipped up as I moved across the room to survey what she'd done. First key, she said. Power. There are energies in the universe that act on all of us. I moved the energies, spun the currents a little, and the universe shifted itself. Well, I guess Ethan had been partly right. So it's like the Force? That's not a bad analogy, actually. My best friend could cause the universe to shift. So much for my being a badass. That is just splendiferous. She chuckled, but then screwed up her face. The problem is, I'm not very good at getting it back down again. So what are you going to do? Leave it for Catcher? Dear God, no. He's already fixed it 3 times this week. I'll just give it the old college try. She cleared her throat and lifted her arms, then glanced back at me. You may want to get out of the way. It can get a little messy. I took the warning to heart, then hightailed it to the threshold between the living room and dining room, where I turned back around to watch. Mallory closed her eyes, and her hair lifted as if she'd put a hand on Tesla coil. I felt my own ponytail lift as energy swirled through the air, as strong as the currents and eddies in a river. "It's just a matter," Mallory said, "of shifting the currents." I looked up. The furniture began to vibrate, then bobble on its feet, the vibration of all those marching bits of furniture sending down a light shower of plaster. "This is the hard part," she said. "You can do it." Like a marching band at halftime, the pieces began to march in little lines around the ceiling. I watched in awe as the love seat followed the couch, which followed a side table around in a circle and then, after a little bob, onto the side wall. Gravity had no more effect there than it had on the ceiling, and the furniture began to move, fantasia-like, down the walls and toward the baseboards. "Tricky, tricky," she said as the furniture stepped down onto the floor again. I glanced back at Mallory, her outstretched arms shaking with the effort, shone with sweat. I'd seen her like this before, one of the first times I'd seen her work her magic. We'd been at a rave site at the time, and she'd offered up a prophecy. But it had taken a lot out of her, and she'd slept in the car on the way home. This looked a lot like that, with much heavier consequences. "Mal, do you need some help?" "I'll get it," she bit out, and the furniture continued its dance, the floor now vibrating beneath as it marched back into place. "Uh-oh," she said. "Uh-oh," I repeated, then took a step backward. "I don't like the sound of uh-oh. I think I'm kicking up dust." I managed to mutter a curse before she sneezed and the rest of the stuff on the ceiling crashed to the ground. Luckily, the electronics had already made their way down. But the rest of the stuff that I could see, after I'd waved a hand at the dust she'd kicked up, was in a shambles. "Mal? I'm okay," she said, then appeared through the fog of plaster and dust that had accumulated over 20 years her aunt had lived in the brownstone. She stood by me and turned around, and we surveyed the damage. There was a snowfall of knickknacks on the ground. Kittens and porcelain roses and other items purchased by Mal's aunt on one of her television shopping network sprees. The sofa had successfully finished the journey right side up, but the love seat stood precariously on its side. The bookcase was facing down, but the books were stacked in tidy piles beside it. "Hey, the books look nice. Watch it, smartass." I bit back a snicker that threatened to bubble up, and I had to press my lips together to keep from laughing. "I'm still learning," she said. "Even vampires need practice," I supportively added. "No shit, since Selena batted you around like you were Tom to her Jerry." I slid her a sideways and none too friendly glance. "What?" she asked with a shrug. "So Selena likes to play with her food." "At least Selena didn't destroy Cadogan House in the process." "Oh, yeah? Check this." She stomped, literally stomped, back to the kitchen, moved around the island, and opened up a long drawer that held my chocolate stash. She reached in and, her eyes still on me, moved a hand through my treasure trove until she pulled out a long, paper-wrapped bar of gourmet dark chocolate. Grinning evilly at her bounty, she held it before her with both hands, then ripped a corner off the packaging. "That's one of my favorites," I warned her. "Oh, is it?" she asked, then used her teeth to snap off a giant corner of the bar. "Mallory, that's just hateful."
"Sometimes a woman needs to hate,"
was what I thought she said over a mouthful of 73% dark chocolate that I'd been able to find only at a tiny shop near U of C. On the other hand, I'd done without for this long. "Fine," I said, crossing my arms over my chest. "If we were going to fight like adolescent sisters, might as well go the distance. Eat it. Eat the whole thing while I'm standing here." "Maybe I..." she broke off, raising the back of her free hand and chewing a mouthful of chocolate.
"Maybe I will," she finally got out.
As if acting on a dare, she arched an eyebrow, then snapped another bite, although a tiny one, off the end.
Don't snap my chocolate at me. I'll snap whatever I want at you, whenever I want. It's my house.
It's my chocolate.
Then you probably shouldn't have left it here, said a manly voice in the doorway. We both turned to look at the door. Catcher stood in the doorway, hands on his hips.
Does either one of you want to explain what the hell happened to my house?
We're making up, Mallory said, still trying to masticate the mouth of chocolate.
By destroying the living room and going into sugar shock?
She shrugged and swallowed. Seemed like a good idea at the time. As if suddenly realizing that the gruff boy she loved had come home, she smiled, her face lit up with it. Hey, baby. He shook his head in amusement, then pushed off the door and went to her.
I rolled my eyes. Can we keep it PG for the kids, please?
Think of the children. Catcher stopped when he reached her and clucked her chin between his thumb and fist.
Just for that, we're going to have a steamy makeout scene. I rolled my eyes and looked away,
but not before I caught sight of him dipping his head for a kiss.
I gave them a few seconds before I began clearing my throat. The universal symbol of uncomfortable friends and roommates everywhere.
So, Catcher said, moving around me to nab the last piece of casserole-style pizza from the box when they finally unlocked lips.
How are things at Cadogan House?
Merritt and Ethan did it. He paused mid-bite, then turned to stare at me. My cheeks flamed red.
If you're here instead of basking in the glow, I assume he did something incredibly stupid.
That's my boy, Mallory said, then slapped him on the butt and headed for the fridge. She opened it, grabbed two cans of diet soda, handed one to me, then popped the top on the other one.
What an idiot, Catcher said, and put the rest of the slice back in the box.
He placed his hands on his hips, his expression mystified.
You know that I've known Sullivan a long time, right?
When he looked at me, brows raised, I nodded. I didn't know how they knew each other, but I knew they went way back, or so Catcher had said.
This may not come as much consolation after the deed is done, so to speak, but he'll regret it, and probably sooner rather than later. But you got something out of it, at least.
At my lifted brows, he pointed at Mallory.
You two are talking again.
Mallory looked at me from across the island. Funny, isn't it, that it took Darth Sullivan to bring us back together?
Well, he did have the honor of tearing us under in the first place.
She held out her hands and wiggled her fingers.
Come on over. Let's hug it out.
And so we did. When Catcher got his appetite back, he worked on the last slice while Mallory and I rummaged through my chocolate collection. As an act of good faith, I donated most of it to the Carmichael Bell House. But that didn't stop me from stuffing chocolate bars filled with almonds and dried cherries into my pockets before I left. I also nabbed a bag of chocolate-coated pecans and sat down to catch up with Mallory's beau. He didn't yet have any additional information about the investigation of the bar shooting, but I filled him in on the basic details of the PAC's meeting at the Brex. Eventually, I thought to check my watch. Dawn was approaching, and I still had to meet Ethan and Luke to discuss the convocation. I need to head back to the house.
Maybe Ethan's come to his senses since you've been gone, Mallory said. Maybe he's pining outside your door.
We both contemplated that for a second before snorting simultaneously.
And leprechauns might poop rainbows on your pillow, she said.
What do I do, Mal? Do I argue with him? Tell him he's wrong and we can work this out? Ignore him? Scream? How am I supposed to work with him?
I think that's exactly his point, Mayor.
As for arguing, think about it this way. Do you want to be with a man who has to be convinced to be with you?
Not when you put it like that.
She nodded, then patted my cheek.
You're ready. Go home.
I knew when to take an order. Chapter 14, House of Pain. I found Luke perched on the edge of the conference table that took up the middle of the operations room. Lindsay was at the computer station opposite Luke, where she could monitor feed from the security cameras in and around the house, or research whatever supernatural drama was threatening to bubble over into Hyde Park. They both looked up when I entered.
How bad was it?
Luke asked. I guessed he and Ethan had talked about what had happened at the Brex.
It wasn't fabulous.
Lindsay swiveled around in her chair. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Her voice rang with quiet concern.
Not especially.
Ethan seemed weird, she said. He didn't really say anything about you and him, but he seemed really weird.
I almost snarked back, but when I saw the worry in her expression and heard the concern in her tone, I threw her a bone.
I was dumped, and I'd like to think about something else for a little while.
I pointed at the spread of documents on the conference table. What's all this?
He did what?
I appreciated the shock and dismay in Lindsay's voice, but shook my head. Business, please.
Your show, Sentinel, Luke said, then hopped off the table and turned to face it. This is prep work for your convocation field trip. Schematics of St. Bridget's Cathedral.
The door behind us opened, and Ethan walked in. He gave me a quick nod of acknowledgement before settling his gaze on the table. I reminded myself that I'd managed a relatively professional relationship with Ethan for all but one of the nights we'd known each other. If he was going to reject me for fear of mixing the personal and the professional, I could play the all-business vampire as well.
Plans? Ethan asked.
Luke nodded. Ask and ye shall receive.
Technically, Lindsay said, turning back to her monitor. Check your email and ye shall receive them from the apex of the North American Central.
Details, Luke said. They're here now.
Ethan walked around the conference table to stand next to Luke. I followed and took point at Luke's other side.
Your analysis? Ethan asked.
Luke put on his game face.
I had two main goals. One, identifying trouble spots. Areas that snipers could sneak into, Parsons holes, that kind of thing. Two, identifying exits.
And what did you find? Ethan asked.
Luke began flipping through the blueprints. There are two main parts to the church. First up, the original structure, built in the late 19th century. Old religious architecture in Chicago means architectural anomalies. This architect was apparently paranoid. So there are plenty of hidey holes.
Shifters, Ethan and I simultaneously guessed.
Quite possibly, Luke said. We found two trap doors in the main part of the building.
He pointed them out on the plans, one in the sanctuary proper, just behind the pulpit, and one in the choir stalls behind the pulpit.
What else? Ethan asked.
Luke flipped over a couple of sheets of paper. In the 1970s, they remodeled the building and added the classroom wing, and at that time, they added what looks to be a panic room. He pointed it out on the blueprints. It's in the basement. Looks like it started out as a bomb shelter, but in the remodel, they reinforced it with concrete and added some wiring. So those are your question marks.
Ethan nodded. Exits?
Luke flipped back to the schematic of the main floor of the church.
Front doors, obviously. There's also an exit inside the sanctuary on the right.
He pointed it out, then traced his finger down the long, narrow sanctuary, and then through a doorway on the left to another set of rooms.
These are the offices and classrooms.
He pointed out the exit at the end of that corridor. Exit point is here, although there are windows in all the rooms in the event things go completely foobar. I leaned toward Lindsay, who'd stood up to join us at the table, still wearing the slim, wireless headset that kept her in communication with the guard on the ground patrol tonight. Either Kelly or Juliet, since they were the only remaining guards, and the fairies outside the gate.
He seems to be having fun, I told her.
He's in hog heaven, she whispered back. Things have been peaceful for so long, he hasn't needed to do this kind of advanced work. All of a sudden, we get a sentinel, and shifters want vampires to come out and play.
Yeah, I said dryly.
Clearly, this whole convocation idea is focused on getting to know me better. It's the mixer you've always dreamed of.
But hairier, she said. Much hairier.
Ethan rubbed a hand across his jaw. What else do we need to know?
That's about it for the architecture, Luke said.
He pulled out a chair and sat down. Ethan and I did the same. Lindsay returned to her computer station.
But if it's going to be you two against 300-odd shifters, we need to talk about contingencies, worst-case scenarios.
Ethan crossed one leg over the other, settling in for a strategic conference. Your thoughts?
Three scenarios come to mind. First, an attack from outside the conference, something akin to what you saw at the bar. Second, the shifters are pissed that you're there, and they attack you.
Good times, Lindsay whispered.
I nodded, my stomach knotting a bit. Hunkering down behind a bar to avoid bullets, or even a little arm-grabbing by a pack bully, was one thing. Facing off against portions of four packs of shifters was something else entirely.
Third, the shifters can't make a decision. They get pissed at one another, and things go magically wonky.
Ethan slid Luke a glance.
Wonky? That's your official conclusion? Signed and sealed. I assume you get the larger point.
Ethan blew out a breath.
I get it. I'm not thrilled about it, but I get it.
Well, what can we do to keep things calm?
How proactive can we be on that? I asked.
Heads turned to face me.
What are you thinking, Sentinel? Ethan asked.
Vampires have the ability to glamour. I can't seem to do it. I shifted my gaze to Ethan. But I bet you can.
The room was quiet for a moment.
You're thinking we glamour a church full of shifters to keep them calm, anesthetized?
Could it be done?
Luke hunched over the table, placed an elbow atop it, and put his chin in his hand.
It's theoretically possible. But we've never seen evidence shifters are especially susceptible to glamour. They're magical beings. I'd be afraid they'd sense it, feel it, and if they suspected we were attempting to manipulate them, all hell would break loose, Ethan finished.
Interesting proposal, Sentinel, but let's stick to basic bluffing. We'll stand there with our swords and smile politely, and reach for the handles if things get nasty.
Oh, and speaking of, Luke said, sitting again and pushing back his chair.
He walked over to his desk, where he picked up a small glossy white box.
End of the fiscal year is coming up, and we had a little bit of extra coin in our budget.
Thank you for returning it to the house treasury, Ethan muttered. But I could see the gleam of boyish pleasure in his eyes as Luke flipped open the lid and pulled out two tiny earpieces.
Tiniest buds on the market, Luke said,
dropping the earbuds into his hand and walking them back to us. He flipped his hand over and placed them on the table.
Receiver, microphone, wireless transmitter. There's one for each of you. We'll hear you through the receivers. If things do, in fact, go wonky, just give the word and we'll have a dozen guards outside the church.
A dozen? I asked, surprised. We're down a guard. And even if you, Lindsay, Juliet, and Kelly were there, that leaves eight missing vamps and no one guarding the house.
Since your field trip to Navarre, Luke began, we've spoken with the guard captains at Navarre and Gray. They've loaned us vampires in the event of an emergency.
I sat up straight at the mention of Jonah, my would-be Red Guard partner. I guess he wasn't above offering a little help to the Cadogan Sentinel, even if he didn't think much of her abilities. Ethan cocked his head at me.
Are you all right, Sentinel? You seem flushed.
I'm fine, I covered, smiling weakly. Just surprised about the inter-office cooperation.
Ethan shook his head. We haven't cleared additional guards with Gabriel. I'm not sure they'd appreciate having nearly a dozen more vampires at their convocation.
Luke shrugged.
Can't be helped. I'm sure as shit not sending you in without the possibility of backup. Besides, if this thing goes bad enough to require us to send in a dozen more friendlies, I'm guessing Gabriel's not going to be too concerned.
Ethan nodded.
We wouldn't have a lot of time to negotiate the details of a full contract. But I could also give the fairies a call to see if they'd be interested in posting some sentries or snipers around the church.
Frowning contemplatively, Ethan crossed his arms.
I think the cost of recruiting and negotiating with the fairies at this point would exceed the benefit, especially since there's no guarantee we'd need them.
Whatever you think best, Liege, Luke said with a snicker.
I have decided opinions in that area, Ethan said crisply, approbation in his voice.
And our safe word? Wonderwall.
Lindsay turned around and cast Luke a sardonic look.
Your safe word is the name of an Oasis song?
Blondie, I'm the arbiter of all things fashionable in this house. Why not music?
Lindsay snorted, then turned back to her monitor and began clicking through computer screens.
Spoken by a man wearing cowboy boots. I mean, seriously, who wears cowboy boots?
Ethan and I both checked out his shoes. He was, indeed, wearing well-worn alligator skin boots.
Epitome of fashion, Luke said. I watch the MTVs. I know what the kids are wearing.
The kids are a century younger than you, Haas.
Children, Ethan interjected, although the amusement was clear on his face. Let's stay on point. I have matters to attend to. Lindsay, chastened, moved back to her monitor. I had the same urge to turn away, but no computer to turn to. I was used to their flirty banter, and usually I participated in it. But today, it left me feeling hollow. It was too casual, and I was still trying to find my emotional footing. It helped a little that Ethan seemed equally discomforted. Half of his questions had been one or two words, and he'd hardly spared a word about convocation prep. This was business, sure, but even Ethan had a sense of humor. Well, on occasion. Our plan in the event of these contingencies? Ethan asked.
Luke stood up again, moved to the blueprints, and pulled out a map of Ukrainian village.
If things do go wonky, get out of the building however you can, he said. Then meet here.
He tapped a point on the map about 2 blocks from the church, and we all leaned up to see.
We're meeting at Joe's Chicken and Biscuits, Luke said. As the name suggests, Joe is one of the Windy City's finest purveyors of chicken and biscuits. That's your rendezvous point. Anything happens, you get back there. We'll pick you up. I just ask that you grab a 10-piece for me and the missus here. If things go bad, do we fight back?
Ethan looked at me. Some of the shifters are already suspicious of us, I said, leaving unspoken the probability that they'd be even more suspicious after tonight. I don't want to make things worse. Ethan frowned and rubbed his forehead. The GP has a position statement on shifters.
Do not fire until fired upon, Luke offered.
Ethan nodded matter-of-factly. We do not strike with weapons unless we are threatened, or unless they are threatening to harm Gabriel.
We were all silent for a moment, maybe wondering whether I'd been sufficiently threatened to justify Ethan's reaction, or whether the GP was going to want a few words with our master.
We all jumped a bit when Ethan's cell phone rang.
He pulled it from his pocket, checked the screen, then pushed back his chair and rose.
You may respond if necessary, but we are there to offer our support, not make enemies without provocation. There are likely alliances within the packs, just as there are outside them, and we don't want to run afoul of any lines there.
I'd been born to one of Chicago's wealthiest families. I was trained to play standoffish.
I have an appointment, Ethan said, then slipped the phone back into his jacket. You're dismissed. We'll assemble here 2 hours before midnight tomorrow.
Liege, I respectfully said, and caught Lindsay's eye roll at my grateful condescension, the fancy vampire term for ass-kissing. When Ethan was out of the room, presumably on his way to some important meeting, and the door was shut behind him, she snorted.
I can't believe you're playing polite after he bailed.
I warned you earlier, no personal commentary.
One or two questions? They're pretty specific.
Biologically specific, that is. Luke, your employee is being petulant.
Welcome to my world, Sentinel. Welcome to my world.
It being bare minutes before dawn, Lindsay and Luke shut down the house controls and officially handed the protection of the house to the mercenary fairies who guarded it while we slept. She offered to walk me upstairs for moral support. More likely, she wanted time to quiz me on Ethan's decision that we couldn't date.
I only need a detail or two, she said as soon as we'd closed the ops room door behind us.
There are no details to offer. We had a fling. He decided he couldn't afford to date me. So now I'm working on my I will survive vibe.
We took the stairs to the first floor and had just turned the corner at the stairwell when we were blocked by an entourage of vampires. Margot, Catherine, and a female vamp with a shaved head and coca skin whom I didn't yet know. They literally stopped in front of us, a blockade to the rest of the first floor.
Chicas? Lindsay said, propping her hands on her hips. What's up?
The girls shared a look, then glanced at me, then turned back to Lindsay.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, Margot said, but we have a visitor.
Lindsay looked at me and frowned. Right now? It's nearly dawn, and there wasn't anyone in the dailies. The dailies were our once daily dossier of news and events at the house. Planned guests and off-campus trips planned by Ethan or Malik. Today's had been dominated by the shifter party, so I shook my head. Margot, who looked mighty uncomfortable, gnawed at the edge of her lip.
I'm not supposed to say anything.
Catherine bumped her with an elbow. Spill it.
He asked me a couple of hours ago to make a big sunset meal, Margot said. Steak au poivre, soufflé, the whole bit. And I thought something was odd, because he hasn't asked for steak au poivre in years.
My first thought, given that the food was French and the arrival secret, was that Ethan had invited Selena over for a sit-down. Since she tried to have me killed, it made sense that he'd want to keep the meeting on the down low. Then we heard he was bringing in a guest, said the new girl, and that she's on her way from the airport.
Oh, and this is Michelle,
Lindsay absently whispered, gesturing toward the new girl. I offered Michelle a smile and a wave.
If it matters at all, Catherine said, if it makes any difference, he's being a huge